Welcome to Cinema Chop Shop. Watch.
So I went out on a limb today and decided to cut my own hair.
Oh no.
Oh God.
I did, and I don't think I did a very bad job. What I really did is I stuck to the sides and the back and then tried to blend a little bit. There's a couple of gaps. It'll be all right. But this is not a Quarantine Mistakes podcast. Welcome to Season 6, Episode 23 of Cinema Chop Shop. This is a movie podcast that concedes that remakes are going to happen, so why shouldn't movie buffs,
like us,
decide who is recast in those iconic roles? My name is...
Travic Designer.
Ah, very nice. And I will be your host, and I am joined once again remotely today by my co-host and co-producer, Opening Animation.
Very good.
We're also extremely excited to welcome back to the show regular guest Title Chell Sequence.
Oh my god!
That's great.
That's so funny.
They're very related. The two nicknames today, and the three nicknames, in fact. Further description of the show: the tagline says "Watch, Chop, Retrofit," because essentially that's what we do. We watch older movies ahead of time. And sometimes they're classic films, sometimes they're not, and we retrofit them by tweaking the design with new parts. Quick disclaimer, we're not actually in favor of remakes and reboots and sequels and really the monotony of stuff that's coming out of or was coming out of Hollywood cinemas before this brief pause. This is more of an exercise in satire and irony. We try to be funny.
And sometimes we succeed.
And so that will bring us to my next question for you. Can you guys point out an example of a bad or unnecessary remake? Chelsea, as our guest, would you like to go first?
Yeah, I don't appreciate all of the live remakes that have been happening, like Sound of Music and Grease. Sound of Music wasn't bad. Grease was... And Little Mermaid, I think they did. They can stop doing that.
How did they do a live Little Mermaid?
I don't know. I didn't watch it. Because it was bad. I'm sure.
And so my example... Oh, Sean, did you have one?
Yes, and I hope I'm stealing yours.
What is it?
Pertinent to this episode, Around the World in 80 Days.
No, I do not have that, but that's good. Mine is a recent movie, I think it's 2019, called The Hustle, and it's a remake of the 1988 film Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which is a superior film. Next, we've got our movie news segment, and this is where throughout the week we try to pay attention to stories that we think are applicable to the subject of our episode and movie news in general. First, we've got an RIP. And it is, on the bright side, not a COVID-19 death. John Lafia has died. He was the director of Child's Play. Was it Child's Play 1 and 2 or just 2?
I'm thinking maybe 1 and 2.
Yeah, and he was 63. On a not-so-bright note, it was suicide. Train to Busan director heads to Netflix with a new supernatural horror show. Now, we've already talked about the sequel to Train to Busan Peninsula, but this is something different. It's going to be a supernatural horror show directed by the Train to Busan guy. Oh, Sopranos star Joey Pants, friend of the show. The show is a fan of his, suffered a severe head injury after being hit by a car. But it is since been reported that he is recovering fine. Next, Nicolas Cage goes full Tiger King as Joe Exotic in a scripted TV series. Now, this marks the first television role of Nicolas Cage's vast career.
And if there were ever a role that was perfectly made for him, I think this is it.
He was born to play this.
It's going to be very interesting. Taika Waititi is getting his own Star Wars movie.
I'm so excited. This made me so happy.
We've talked about Taika Waititi a lot and how he was recently the director of Jojo Rabbit. He also did Thor Ragnarok, and he's a really, really awesome New Zealand filmmaker. Also, What We Do in the Shadows. So I think this is a very good, a fitting pick as well. All right, so speaking of Star Wars, Canadian cops take down a teenage girl in a Stormtrooper costume over a toy gun. Now, there is a video of this. You can look that headline up on the New York Post. And she is trying to, at the request of her manager, trying to drum up business for their struggling Star Wars-themed restaurant. I saw a article the other day that says that the last Blockbuster on Earth is still open, and it just so happens to be in my home state of Oregon in a little town called Bend. So I posted a copy of, or a link to the article. It's a copy of the article to Facebook. I posted a link, and my cousin, who still lives out there, was like, man, I was just in Bend the other day and I saw it, but I wasn't aware that it was the last one. Birth Movies Death, which is a movie news website primarily, and I get a lot of news stories from there. They, up until very recently, were owned by, if not closely associated with, Alamo Drafthouse. And due to all of the massive furloughs that have had to been made across the board, they were bought out by another group called CineState, which I had never heard of, but it turns out they are the parent company of Fangoria, which I think has gone to an all online format now.
Makes sense.
All right, so I think I hear a phone ringing in the background, so that must mean that it's time for the Department of Corrections Department with Chief Corrections Officer Dana.
Hi, Choppers. It's me, the hardest working corrections officer in the business. Irfan Khan passed away from complications due to a colon infection, not complications due to Parkinson's. Steven Spielberg is the clerk at the Cook County Tax Office. Frank Oz is the fellow CO who returns Jake's belongings to him in the opening scene. As Chelsea and Sean tag team to confirm, J.K. Simmons is the spokesman for Farmers Insurance, not State Farm. That's Jake from State Farm. Aight, I'll see y'all next week. Now I'm going to take it to the bridge.
And that will close the doors on the Department of Corrections Department for this week. Thank you so much, Dana, for noticing that I was right about something. Which brings us to the theme of our episode. Today, May 8th, is the 100th birth date of the movie and graphic design artist Saul Bass. So he was born 100 years ago today, as of this recording. Saul Bass was a prominent American graphic designer of the 20th century. He largely designed motion picture title sequences, corporate logos, and movie posters. He was a pioneer of the modern title sequence designing. He enjoyed four decades of success in his career. He won an Academy Award for his exquisite graphic designing. His iconic title sequences appeared in popular films, so many of them, The Man with the Golden Arm, Psycho, North by Northwest, and many, many more. Now, Sean, with your background in graphic design, is there anything you wanted to say about Saul Bass?
Yeah, I mean, in addition to all the great film work, he's done some great graphic design work that you've probably recognized and have seen throughout the years. He did the YWCA logo. He did the Warner Communications logo from the mid-70s. That was the real, like, the three bubbly lines. Okay. He did the United Way logo. He did United Airlines logo.
Did he do Westinghouse?
He did Geffen Records. Let's see. Don't see Westinghouse. But
now, let me ask you this. Visually, could you describe his style? I know it was fairly diverse over his career, but he does have kind of a signature style.
Yeah, I think his most iconic work are his illustrations and stuff that look like they may be made of cut paper.
Right.
You know, very bold graphics.
And I was thinking about that as well, and it seems like he was influenced by some of the later work of Henri Matisse with his cutout period.
Yeah, I can see that.
If any of the listeners are not familiar with his work, I'm going to post a YouTube video that is about 4 hours long, and it's just a mashup of a whole bunch of titles that he did from way back in his Otto Preminger days all the way up to like Casino with Martin Scorsese. So I'll put that on our Facebook page as kind of like a primer. That brings us to our next segment, which is the Midnight Double Feature. And this is where we go around the panel and we each pick two movies that relate to our subject at hand and talk about how they are at least tangentially related to each other and would make a good pairing for a double feature. Chelsea, as our guest, would you like to go first with your Midnight Double Feature?
Sure. It's funny that you mentioned Scorsese because I'm using Casino in my double feature and I'm pairing it with Ocean's 11. Oh, and nice. Well, the title sequences both use kind of the Casino lights, but in really different ways. Ocean's 11 came out in 1960.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. And it's very much that like mid-century modern kind of aesthetic.
Yeah.
And Casino from 95 is very sort of in your face a little bit more. But I'm pairing those two.
I like that pairing. I like the Casino theme carrying through there. And Sean, what are you thinking about for yours?
All right. I'm going to go with two of his collaborations with Otto Preminger, the notoriously hard to work with director.
Okay.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They said that Preminger was very demanding.
Okay.
Very demanding on set. 1959, Anatomy of a Murder. This was probably one of Saul Bass's most iconic intros early in his career. It starts with the parts of the dismembered body coming together to form the kind of scene of the crime type shot of a limp body on the ground. This stars Jimmy Stewart. It's got the beautiful Lee Remick in it. It's a courtroom drama. It is about an army officer who is stationed in the Upper Michigan Peninsula. He murders somebody and he is on trial for murder, and his wife is kind of at the center of the whole story because she claims she was raped by the man who her husband murdered. And Jimmy Stewart is the small town all shucks kind of attorney representing the opposing counsel. George C. Scott plays one of the attorneys, a visiting attorney from the big city of Lansing. And it's a fantastic courtroom drama. If you like really, really good dialogue, this is a fantastic movie in that regard. My only knock against it, and I consider this to be one of my near perfect movies, my only knock against it, if you're going to set a film in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, you should use the iconic Upper accent for anybody who's native to that area.
Oh, yeah.
No one did. And it would, and it's funny you should say, oh yeah, it would be like watching Fargo without any sort of nuance to the accents that of any of the characters.
Right.
So I'm pairing this with 1965's Bunny Lake is Missing. And I consider this to be Saul Bass's finest intro credits. Instead of using his typical animation style, you were presented a black screen and a grayscale black and white footage hand reaches across and starts peeling away parts of the screen to reveal the credits underneath the tears on a white field. And it kind of resets itself and it comes in from various directions to reveal it until finally at the end of the credit sequence, you're presented, directed by Otto Preminger, and it tears away a little silhouette of a tiny girl, like a 4-year-old girl.
Okay.
And this is a story of a woman and her brother who have recently moved to England for his job. And she starts her first full week, you know, living there by taking her 4-year-old girl to kindergarten. And the girl goes missing. She goes to pick her up at the end of the day. She's not there. And they have to go to the police. Sir Laurence Olivier plays the lead detective on the case. And through various indications, you start to wonder, does this child really exist or not? Is it just a figment of the lead actress who is Carol Lindley, of her imagination?
Nice. Now, which of the two do you think is a better film?
Oh, Anatomy of a Murder, hands down.
Okay. All right. Well, I had originally planned to do a couple of film noir movies, and I wasn't able to find a good stream or a decent copy, even for rental or anything like that, of one of them. So I had to change it up kind of in the middle of the game. So I went with a couple of Westerns, both from 1958. The first one is called Cowboy, and it's got a 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, directed by Delmer Davies, D-A-V-E-S, Daves, Davies, maybe. And so it is, we start out with the title sequence, which is different in that it's all this Western iconography, like pictures of spurs and boots, and but they're all kind of interacting with each other and kind of setting the motif for the movie. They want you to know, if you didn't already from the title Cowboy, that you're in for a Western. So we've got, it starts out in Chicago, and we've got this hotel clerk who's played by Jack Lemmon, and he's in love with a wealthy Mexican cattleman's daughter. And shortly thereafter, this very successful American cattleman comes in with his outfit, his whole crew, and they've been on the trail for 6 months. And he overhears a conversation where that cattleman, whose name is Tom Reese, is about to go back to Mexico to buy a whole bunch of cattle from his love's father. So he convinces the reluctant cattleman to let him join on as a partner. And the only reason that Reese lets Harris, who that's Jack Lemmon's character, join the cattle drive is because he needs the money, because that first night back in town, he blew it all in a poker game. And then he agrees. And the next morning he tries to go back on it. And he's like, no, I trusted your word and I don't want the money back. Spoiler alert, when he gets to Mexico, the father has already married off the girl that he was chasing after in the first place. The next one that I'm going to mention is also from 1958. And it also has a 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, and I think that is deserving. It's called The Big Country, and it was directed by William Wyler, who also directed Ben-Hur, the second version of Ben-Hur. Oh, wow. And so that also had starred Charlton Heston, who's in this as well, but he's not the lead. The lead is Gregory Peck, and he plays a sea captain who's returning to the American West to marry his fiance, who is played by Carol Baker. Her name's Patricia. And he enters into a land and water feud between his future father-in-law, Major Terrell, played by Charles Bickford, and the rough and lawless Hennessy family, led by Rufus, played by Burl Ives. And I'm pretty sure Burl Ives won the Best Supporting Actor award for this movie. But it was also one of my family's favorite Westerns, if not my parents, one of their favorite movies in general.
Oh, cool. I haven't seen it.
I recommend it if you've got the time. Oh, so I should also mention the title sequence on this was different from the previous movie. It had live action scenes of stampedes and horses running and things like that. But they were very layered on top of each other and kind of moving in different directions. So it kind of created this visual chaos. And so, yeah, that's going to be my double feature. I'm going to say strong recommend on Big Country. So recommend on Cowboy.
I got strong recommends on my two.
Good deal. Very good. That means it's time for the recast. Now, this is where we take a particular film within our subject, and we watch it, we all watch it ahead of time, and then we hypothetically recast a few of the main roles. And the first one is from 1955. It's got 86% on Rotten Tomatoes, and it was directed by the previously mentioned Otto Preminger. It's called The Man with the Golden Arm. What did you guys think of this?
I was into it until probably about the second half, when it got a little silly and a little much. but I did enjoy it.
I enjoyed it overall. There are about three gaffes in the film that kind of made me chuckle.
Uh-huh.
That being the dummy getting pushed over the stair railing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sinatra's very accented shaky hands.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple of things kind of were like, oh man, you really took me out of this story.
Speaking of the story, we've got this illegal card dealer played by Frank Sinatra, and his name is Frankie Machine. And he gets out of a drug addiction facility, and they never actually say that it's heroin, but it's very strongly implied.
Oh, yeah.
And he decides to straighten up. He's armed with nothing but an old drum set. He tries to get honest work as a drummer, but when his former employer, small-time con man Schwefka, played by Robert Strauss, and Frankie's old drug dealer, Louie, played by Darren McGavin, re-enter his life, Frankie finds it hard to stay clean and eventually finds himself succumbing to his old habits. Not only that, we've got his home situation. Now, his wife, Zosh, played by Eleanor Parker, has stuck by him while he was, cleaning up in the facility.
I just remembered what made me laugh. When Zosh says that she's 25.
Yeah.
And her death.
And well, she was 33, but God bless, that actress looked a lot older than that.
Oh, yeah.
So she is also running her own little con here. She is pretending to be crippled. She's pretending to be in a wheelchair due to a car accident that was blamed on Frank Sinatra. He doesn't reveal that she can actually walk because she thinks that he will leave her. Really similar to the Betty Davis movie scenario we saw. Whatever Happened to Baby Jane?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, cool. So he also, things are even more compounded when the drug dealer, Louie, discovers that Zosh can actually walk. So spoiler alert, she pushes him over a balcony so he can't reveal her secret. Also, we've got the old flame, Molly Novotny, played by Kim Novak, who was only 22 at the time.
Yes.
Yep.
All right. And even though there's not really anything going on between her and Machine anymore, it still makes Zosh very jealous. And it doesn't help that she lives downstairs. Then we've got the sidekick, Sparrow. Now, Sparrow's a little bit of comic relief in here. He is played by Arnold Stang, who is a very goofy, nerdy actor. And he runs a con painting and selling homeless dogs. He catches homeless dogs and then he paints them and he tries to sell them to rich people. And then finally, we've got Robert Strauss. Oh, no, not finally. We've got Nifty Louie, played by Darren McGavin, who was 33 at the time. He's the former drug dealer. Then we've got Zero Schwefka, who is Frank's old boss, who runs an illegal card game in which Frank Dealer Machine is the dealer. All right, so first up, we've got Frank Sinatra. He was 40 at the time, playing Frankie Dealer Machine. And Chelsea, who's your machine?
I kind of feel like I copped out on this recast a little bit, but this one was hard. And I've used him before. He has been in Frozen and Frozen 2 as a voice actor, but I think most notably everybody would know him from Mindhunter or his brief stint on Glee.
Okay.
I went with Jonathan Groff.
Yeah. I like him on Mindhunter.
Oh, I love him on Mindhunter.
I went with an actor who's 39 years old, and I wanted to kind of, this is more of a present day kind of grittier version of the film. So I wanted someone who could play the drug addict a lot better, a lot more believably. This actor was in The Master, Papillon. He got an Academy Award for Bohemian Rhapsody for some reason. He was in Mr. Robot. It's Rami Malek.
Interesting.
Hmm.
Right. It seems like we're all going in very different directions. Yeah. I picked an actor who's 42 now. He got his start on a show called Freaks and Geeks. He was in The Interview. He was in Spring Breakers and The Disaster Artist. I went with James Franco.
Okay, I can see it.
All right, so next up, we've got Zosh. Sophia Zosh Machine. She was played by Eleanor Parker, who, did you say 33 at the time?
33.
All right, and Chelsea?
My actress is 38, but I think it fits. So she looks older. But I think she could do this and do it better. She was in Girl Interrupted. But most notably where I have seen her is The Handmaid's Tale. I went with Elizabeth Moss.
Oh, she's hot right now. So, Sean, who's your Zosh?
I wanted to get her into a more believable age since she says that she was 25. This actress is 27 years old, and she can kind of play contemptible crazy. So that's important for this part. She was in Star Wars Episode 9, briefly. She was in Free Guy. Actually, I'm sorry. She's going to be in Free Guy. That's an upcoming film.
Ryan Reynolds.
With Ryan Reynolds. Thank you. And she was in the TV series Dr. Foster, A Woman Scorned. But most people will know her from the TV series Killing Eve as Villanelle. I went with Jodie Comer.
Okay. I can't picture her.
Have you seen Killing Eve?
No. So that's probably why.
Yeah.
All right. So my actress is 32 now, and she got her start on a TV show called American Gothic. And I've definitely chopped her before. Chelsea, she was in a movie that I think you saw recently called Across the Universe. She had a one season run on True Blood, and she's pretty much the star of Westworld. I went with Evan Rachel Wood.
Yeah, I like that.
So Evan Rachel Wood will be my Zosh. Next up, we've got Molly, played by Kim Novak. And what else should we know Kim Novak from, Sean?
Vertigo.
That's right. And we'll talk more about that next week. But that also applies to this because the title sequence, of course, by Saul Bass.
Yes, it was.
And Chelsea, how did you feel about this one?
Oh, this was the one that I probably struggled with the most. So I picked an actress who is a Disney darling. That's where she got her start. Recently, she's been in a movie called Horse Girl. And kind of where I envision her in this role was from her time on the TV show Insatiable on Netflix. I went with Debbie Ryan.
Okay. Now, let me ask you, is it the body of a horse and the upper body of a girl, or is it the upper body of a horse and the lower body of a girl?
The whole thing was just a shit show.
Was it? Is it just a girl who likes horses?
It's way bizarre. It's one of the more pretentious movies I've seen.
All right, all right. Calm down. We all know how you feel about horses. Sean, who's going to be your Molly?
All right, so I was thinking that in my amped up modern day grittier version, you know, Kim Novak was a bit of a badass. She worked at kind of a burlesque club, and she always had guys pounding her and pawing at her. Yet she was just like, get the fuck off me. And she had the steely resolve to be able to take Frank and help get him clean.
Yeah.
So I wanted somebody that was kind of a bit of a badass, but also had a lot of beauty to kind of be attractive in the love interest and the, you know, the forbidden fruit, if you will. So this actress was in a recent adaptation of The Exorcist as a TV series. She is currently going to be in a TV series that's coming out pretty soon called Trinkets. Most people would know her from Deadpool, but I really liked her in the movie Tragedy Girls. I went with Brianna Hildebrand.
Oh, okay. Nice. Well, my actress, I'm kind of in that same wheelhouse as you, beautiful badass, and she's 29 now. And the three roles that I'm going to mention, all three of them would give it away. But it's funny that you mentioned Deadpool because she's in Deadpool 2. She was in Joker and she's in Atlanta. I went with Zazie Bates. So I switched it up ethnically, but still went with the same character traits. All right, next up, we've got the somewhat Klingeron Sparrow. He's in real life, he was only 3 years younger than Frank Sinatra was at the time. But he kind of clings to Machine's character like a little brother.
Well, he says he's not too smart. He's a little slow.
Yeah, he seems a little bit slow. I wasn't sure how to say that. he'll do anything that machine asks him to, but sometimes that leads to him getting into more trouble in the long run. Chelsea, who's your sparrow?
My actor was in Frozen and Frozen 2, but most recently you can catch him on Avenue 5. I went with Josh Gad.
Oh, okay. Interesting choice.
I think by today's standards, we would probably put Sparrow on the spectrum.
Yeah.
And so with that in mind, my next recast, he's 41 years old. He was in, he did voice work for DuckTales. He was in the Knights of Badassdom. He can currently be seen in an Apple TV series called Mythic Quest. And most people know him from Community. I went with Danny Pudi.
Huh.
Funny.
So I went with Abed.
I don't think it's that funny because wait till you hear mine. He is 41 now. He was in The Knights of Badassdom. He was a voice in Smurfs The Lost Village. He was Brainy Smurfs. And he was Abed on Community. I went with Danny Pudi.
Wow.
I struggled between Josh Gad and him. I was like, me.
I think we all nailed it then.
Wow. But Josh Gad and Danny Pudi are wildly different.
I went more with the look and I made the role. I took it goofier.
Okay.
I see mine more as like a parody.
All right. Next up, we've got Nifty Louie, who is Machine's former drug dealer, played by Darren McGavin, who was 33 at the time. Chelsea, who did you pick for this one?
My actor was in Mad Max, Lawless, Inception. I went with Tom Hardy.
Interesting. Okay. I want to hear what Sean says.
Well, I went with, keeping it gritty, keeping it real. I wanted to get a drug dealer that I could believe is a drug dealer instead of the dad from A Christmas Story. So this actor was in Fruitvale Station. He was in the Terrible Fantastic Four, but he was also in Black Panther, and he was Creed. I went with Michael B. Jordan.
Michael B. Jordan, very awesome. Fruitvale Station is an overlooked gem. I think it got a lot of critical attention at the time, but in the past few years, I see it mentioned less and less frequently. So my Nifty Louie is 43. It's funny that you mentioned Tom Hardy, Chelsea, because I and some other people consider this guy to be Lil Tom Hardy. He was in Prometheus. He was in Spider-Man Homecoming. He was in the excellent Upgrade. He's also pen pals with Sean. I went with Logan Marshall Green.
Yeah, yeah.
I do think that he and Tom Hardy both have facial characteristics that really, really fit well with the Darren McGavin guy.
Nice.
Time. I never realized that he was the dad from A Christmas Story, though.
Yeah, he's also Kolchak the Night Stalker, very short-lived but cult favorite TV series.
All right, I'm excited about this last one. The character is the kind of low-level underworld figure. He runs an illegal card game, and his name is Zero Schwefka. He's played by Robert Strauss, who was 42 at the time. And Robert Strauss, you mentioned earlier, Sean, I don't know if it was on mic, but he also played Animal in what?
Stalag 17.
Yes, that was in our Jailbreak movies, I think. Prison Break movies?
Something like that.
All right. So Robert Strauss was 42. And Chelsea, who did you think about for this role?
So I am not proud of this pick, but I couldn't get this person out of my mind when I was watching the scene where they had the card game that went forever and they figured out that he cheated. And the character was like, honest, I didn't know. And he's like trying to get out of it. And I couldn't stop thinking about Danny McBride.
Nice. I considered him, but he's come up a little bit too often for me. All right. So, Sean, who's going to be your Zero Schwefka?
This is kind of a face value pick for me, but I also think he'd be really good in the part. He's 45 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned him just recently when I was talking about the movie Fanboys. He was in Good Luck Chuck. He was in a film called Don Peyote.
Ah, okay.
But a lot of folks would know him from Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. in the role of Jacob Kowalski. I went with Dan Fogler.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can see that hardcore. My actor is also 42 now, but it took a little bit of digging to figure that out. He's kind of ambiguous about his age on IMDb and Wikipedia. But he started out as a stand-up comedian, and it didn't really take off for him, so he stepped away from it, but since then has had a resurgence in his career. He was in the films Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates. He was in Murder Mystery, the Netflix Adam Sandler movie that wasn't that bad. He's in Bad Therapy, a movie I saw recently that's not very good, but this is where you're really going to be able to picture him, okay? Mm-hmm. He plays Montez on Workaholics.
Okay.
His name is Eric Griffin, although his character on Workaholics has four eyes. All right, so I'm going to say recommend on The Man with the Golden Arm. I had never seen it.
Yeah, it's a recommend for me. I liked it despite the few misgivings I have about it.
And it almost always comes up as one of the examples that people point to for Saul Bass opening sequences and film art.
Oh yeah, that crooked arm is iconic.
I liked that.
Yeah, it's iconic. It's cool.
All right, well, shall we go ahead and go to intermission?
Yeah.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby and have ourselves an animated conversation.
All right, Chop Shoppers, thank you for bearing with us during intermission. This is your host, Travis, and I just have one question for you, Sean. What is one way we could make our podcast more prominent?
Oh, if our listeners would rate and review us on iTunes.
Rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes.
And pin your friends down and force them to do it.
Make them go ahead and do a review. We're very under review.
Like make it a whole pyramid scheme. Get the people under them to do it and multiply.
A podsy scheme.
Ooh, I like it.
Yes. You folks who are listening right now, it would be fantastic if while you're listening or right after, you don't have to stop the show. Don't stop the show. But if afterwards you could go to iTunes and give us a review or a rating, that would be awesome as well. Or on whatever podcatcher app it is that you're listening to us. We're on a few of them. And also, be aware of our online presence. We have a Facebook page. It's facebook.com/cinemachopshop. We're hosted natively online on Podbean. It's Cinema Chop Shop on Podbean. And our Twitter handle is @CinemaChopShop. We do a lot of stuff on there, like our movie marathon, where Sean consistently kicks my ass. Also, our email address is cinemachopshop@gmail.com. You can email us anytime. We check it frequently. The beers that we check in after intermission, you're about to find out about some, are always checked in on Untappd. That's UNTAPPD. And we are Cinema Chop Shop on there. Once again, thank you to you, the listeners. Thank you for tuning in. And enjoy the rest of the show.
And now, on with the show.
All right, Chop Shoppers. Thank you for bearing with us during intermission. Welcome back. And when we come back from intermission, what do we like to do, Sean?
We like to do beer check-ins.
All right. And so I actually have a new beer to check in today. Not really new to me, but we have not checked it in on the show. And it's the first beer I've had on the show in about a month that hasn't been... Pixels by Seminar Brewing. This is a Sierra Nevada Tropical Torpedo IPA. But you've got some that are on theme of sorts, right?
Well, this one's relatively loosely on themed. It's from Bell's Brewing out of Michigan. It's called Lighthearted Ale, as in lighthearted animation, kind of whimsical animation. This is their low-cal IPA. It is 110 calories, so... Given the option of whether you would drink a Mick Ultra or this, I would choose this. Chelsea disagrees.
It's really bitter.
It is a traditional IPA,
it's
though.
It's really bitter.
I'd prefer it to be too bitter than too malty. So next up, let's get into our 2020 movie marathon. And this is where the three of us and whoever else would like to participate try to watch as many new to us movies as we can throughout the calendar year. And the goal being 365, but you're welcome to go above and beyond. And we check them in on Twitter and Letterboxd with the hashtag this year, 2020 movie marathon. And it's the 129th day of the year. As of this recording, I'm on number 182.
I'm at 175.
Nice.
125. 125. Pertinent to the episode, I watched Around the World in 80 Days. This is the Jules Verne story about Phineas Fogg and his trip around the world. It's 2 hours and 50 minutes long, but it's worth it just to get to the Saul Bass credit sequence at the end. He drew every single major character in the film in their credits. Wow. And it's beautiful. It's freaking beautiful. It is an achievement of art and the art form of doing title sequences.
I'm only going to check in one because the other ones, they're documentaries. They're not worth watching.
Do you want to wait until the end and like close down the show, or do you want to go now?
It doesn't matter. I watched Secret Love on Netflix. And it's basically about this lesbian couple that hid their relationship for 60 plus years.
Whoa.
Yeah. And they didn't even tell their family. Actually,
that story was dramatized earlier as Thelma and Louise.
It wasn't. They didn't tell their family until probably 5 years ago. They were so afraid. And it's these two Canadian girls. One of them played in the All-American Baseball League.
Oh, from League of Their Own.
Yes. And they met playing hockey. They moved to Chicago. They worked in the same place at this interior design place. And they just talk about what it was like being in a relationship during those times and how just scary it was. And it was so sad to see how afraid they were to tell their family.
My first check-in this week is going to be a documentary. And it is the quote-unquote live documentary about the Beastie Boys from director Spike Jonze called Beastie Boys Story. And you can see this on Apple TV. And it was cool. It was really cool to see all of that footage. I notoriously didn't have access to a lot of like MTV and media and stuff during a large portion of time. So it was good to see a lot of that. But also it was sad because all three of them are no longer here. But it was well made. I liked the format because you had the two remaining Beastie Boys on stage talking to a live audience as they presented all of this footage and photography and music.
I'm going to check in phase four. This is Saul Bass's only directorial feature.
Uh-huh.
It's very un-Bass-like. Even the credits are low key. It's just like a typeset font and that's it. It is a slow burn sci-fi.
Uh-huh.
Ants become intelligent and begin their conquest of humanity. There's some really cool macro footage of ants doing what the director wants them to do. I can't imagine the amount of film that they shot and wasted. And there's some really trippy photography of seeing things through the ants' multi eyes. It takes a while to get into it, though. I was really bored with it for the first half hour, and then I kind of was like, okay, I get where you're going with this. But again, for what you see of Saul Bass's work in film sequences, this is completely not what I expected.
I saw multiple references to this movie on the internet today, probably because it's his birthday, the day we're recording this. All right, my next check-in is going to be another documentary, and it is newly on HBO, and it's called Natalie Wood, What Remains Behind. And the title is a reference to the poem called Splendor in the Grass, and her character in the movie version of Splendor in the Grass says that line from that poem. So that's why this is titled that. And of course, she's no longer with us under mysterious circumstances, if I can stoke that fire. But this documentary is, it focuses more on her life and her career and her achievements than her premature death. And if I can just springboard off of that, I went ahead and watched Splendor in the Grass with Michelle. And I thought that it was good. It was a solid movie. It's Elia Kazan. But now this is a spoiler for Splendor in the Grass. There's a breakup between her and Warren Beatty. It's Warren Beatty's first movie. And she basically has a breakdown and loses her mind to the extent that she's put away in an institution for like 2.5 years because she got broken up with.
This one's called The Night Clerk. This is a 2020 flick. It's got Ana de Armas in it.
Yay!
As well as Helen Hunt. This is the second Helen Hunt movie I've checked in as many weeks. I enjoyed seeing a protagonist on the spectrum.
Okay.
And I say on the spectrum, it wasn't comical. It wasn't like Rain Man where it was, you know, it just was. You know, it was on the spectrum. That's just part of the story. But the movie wasn't quite sure what it wanted to be. Is it a crime thriller? I mean, you've got John Leguizamo playing the detective. Was it a drama romance where you've got Ana de Armas who's making the moves on this autistic guy? The main character, he's on the spectrum, and he works the evening shift at a hotel. And in order to learn how to interact with people, he records people. And unfortunately, he does it without their knowledge. He has surveillance stuff in all the hotel rooms so he can go back home and watch people and practice his interactions with them. And in doing so, he witnesses a murder and races back to the hotel because he feels compelled to be there. And because he's there at the murder scene, he becomes suspect number one in this murder. And he gets transferred to another hotel in the chain in the same city. And Ana de Armas' character goes to this hotel and befriends him as one of the guests. And she says that she had a autistic brother who had passed away. So she's very sympathetic to him. And as it turns out, I'm just going to spoil this thing. I don't care. It's not worth it. As it turns out, she's working him over so she can get this SD card that has the footage that implicates her boyfriend.
Oh, it's a honeypot. Let's move it on to the second part of our feature segment, which is the recast continued, right?
Part two.
The sequel.
Redux.
And the movie that we're going to do, I'm going to go ahead and tell a little caveat. It's a movie that I refuse to rewatch because they made us watch it in high school. It's called West Side Story. A lot of people love it. It's got a 92% on Rotten Tomatoes. It is a retelling of Romeo and Juliet way before Claire Danes and Leonardo DiCaprio did their thing. But I probably should have rewatched it because I thought that the rival street gangs were both Puerto Rican gangs. And it turns out that's not the case. So I leaned hard on trying to recast Puerto Ricans for every role in this movie. But we'll learn that as we go along. So like I said, it's a basic Romeo and Juliet narrative that is transposed into 1950s New York. Is that correct?
I think so.
Yeah.
And what side of town are they on?
The West.
And it's actually two rival street gangs, the Sharks and the Jets. And the Sharks, are they Puerto Rican?
I can't remember.
Or are the Jets the Puerto Rican ones? But I learned today that one side is actually a group of Polish.
Yes. Polish Americans.
And so that's going to make my recasts interesting. Chelsea, what are your thoughts about this movie?
I love the dancing in this movie. I mean, that's always something that stuck out to me.
The Sharks were Puerto Rican. The Jets were Polish American. I want to say, pertinent to the episode, the only authentic street thing about this entire movie are the ending credits by Saul Bass.
Nice.
The reason I've never liked this movie is it's, and I know it's an adaptation of a Broadway musical.
Right.
It's so squeaky clean and sanitary. You know, there's supposed to be a street gang, but everybody is pristine. But at the end credits, all the credits are written like in chalk on the walls and in graffiti and on street signs. that is the only thing that feels legitimately street to me in this whole thing.
And of course, the lead role, Maria, is played by Natalie Wood, and she came directly from the set of Splendor in the Grass. As soon as they wrapped, she went straight into this. So that's a really interesting juxtaposition in her career, this really serious drama romance versus musical comedy.
Whitewashing.
Yeah. Yeah, she's super white, but she's one of the roles that we're going to recast. Natalie Wood was 23 at the time when she played Maria. Then we've got Tony, who was played by Richard Boehmer. And I learned at least this week, that he was Peter in another movie they made us watch in high school, A Diary of Anne Frank. But later in his career, he went on to be Ben Horn, the hotel owner in the series Twin Peaks.
Yes.
And he plays Tony. He's the Romeo analog. And then we've got Riff, played by Russ Tamblyn, who people would later know as Dr. Jacoby on Twin Peaks. And he's playing Riff. And Riff is the best friend of who?
Tony, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
And then we've got Rita Moreno. She's Anita, and she's Maria's best friend. And then we've got Bernardo, who is the leader of the rival street gang. And he's George Chikaris. So is Riff the leader of the Jets?
I don't know if he was the leader. I can't remember. I can't remember.
But Bernardo is definitely the leader of the Sharks.
Yeah, and Bernardo was Maria's brother.
All right, first up is Maria. And who did you consider for this, Chelsea?
You will know her from absolutely nothing, except a little movie that comes out in December of 2020. Her name is Rachel Zegler, and she's going to play Maria in the remake of West Side Story.
Oh, interesting. Okay, I see what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say it's cheating.
Why reinvent the wheel?
I call it the easy road.
Why?
The low-hanging fruit. I didn't know they were doing a remake of this right now.
Steven Spielberg directed. Yeah.
And Sean?
All right, so my actress is from New Mexico.
Yay!
She is 23 years old, and she is in the Roswell, New Mexico series on CW. She was in Fargo, the TV series. She was in Hell or High Water, but I liked her in the TV series Legion. She was one half of the... They weren't twins. They just occupied the same body. Her name is Amber Midthunder.
Amber Midthunder is a really cool name.
It's a badass name, and she's a badass.
My actress is 25 now. She's not Puerto Rican, but she is Brazilian-American. And enough about her grooming habits. She's in The Perfect Date. She's in Coyote Lake. And she's in Palm Springs. But most people would know her as Veronica Lodge on Riverdale. Her name is Camila Mendez. Next up, we've got Tony, played by Richard Boehmer. And I don't have his age in this. How old was he, Sean?
I have Tony at 22 years old.
Okay. And so, Chelsea, did you pick the guy who's going to play Tony in the remake of West Side Story?
In fact, I did. And he's a little bit more well known. He was in Fault in Our Stars, Baby Driver, Insurgent, Ansel, I can never say his last name, Elgort.
Oh, yeah. From Baby Driver. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's a good pick, actually.
That's who's playing him in this Steven Spielberg remake.
My credit to their casting director.
All right, Sean, who's going to be your pick?
My actor is from Ireland, actually, but I think he can affect an American accent. He was in the History Channel series, The Vikings, or not The Vikings, Vikings, just finished producing a show called Hero of the Young Men, But I loved him in a movie that had a lot to do with music and singing. He played Connor in Sing Street. His name is Ferdia Walsh Pilo.
Okay, cool.
He's all grown up now. You saw Sing Street, didn't you?
I like that movie.
Yeah, it's a fantastic movie.
I think it's from the same director as Once.
Yes.
My Tony is super Puerto Rican. He's 28 now. He's in Day of the Dead 2, Contagium. And I'm not mispronouncing that. It's I-U-M, Contagium. He's in a thing called Bushwick. He's in Can You Ever Forgive Me? And he played Tony on the TV series 13 Reasons Why. His name's Christian Navarro.
Okay.
Just okay?
It's an unfortunate... It's just an...
So here's the thing. Both gangs are Puerto Rican, all right?
Toning down race relations.
Oh, my God.
I love it. It's a colorblind casting. That's so today.
You're so progressive.
All right. Next up, we've got Riff. And Riff was played by Russ Tamblyn. I don't have his age in this either.
26.
26. And who is your pick for this or Steven Spielberg's? Either one, you choose.
Well, it's Steven Spielberg's pick. Okay. And he was in a movie called I Can, I Will, I Did. The Grief of Others. Did a lot of stuff on Broadway, like Law and Order SVU episodes. His name is Mike Aist.
My Riff is 27 years old. And he was in We're the Millers, Detroit, The Chronicles of Narnia, and The Maze Runner. But most people would know him either from his premiere role in Son of Rambo or in Midsommar. I went with Will Poulter.
Oh, okay. All right. My Riff is 25 now. And his mother is of Puerto Rican descent. Excuse me. She's Puerto Rican, Argentinian, and Spanish descent. But his father was of European descent. I think they said English, German, something else, white. He was the voice of Diego on Dora the Explorer.
Yes.
I refuse to say it any other way. He was in Wizards of Waverly Place. He also recently sold his first screenplay called Kings of Suburbia, which he describes as being written in the same vein as his favorite film, Stand By Me. His name is Jake T. Austin. And next up, we've got Anita. Now, Sean, it sounds like you've got some riff with Rita.
I love Rita Moreno because I grew up watching Electric Company and she was a cast member. And she's fantastic. She's an EGOT. She won an Emmy.
Golden Globe.
An Oscar and a Golden Globe. She's awesome. And
Chelsea, dare I ask?
Yeah. So again, this actress is pretty unknown. She was in some movie called Seaside from 2018 and pretty much nothing else.
Except
she is going to be in the 2020 version of West Side Story. She's in fact going to play Anita. Her name is Ariana DeBose.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
We all know her.
Obviously.
Cool deal. Sean, make a note. Chelsea's not coming back next week.
So mean.
Sean, who is your Anita, your Rita Moreno?
All right. This is strictly, well, it is face value. She's a good actress, but it was face value. The whole time I'm watching Rita Moreno, which West Side Story, Rita Moreno does not look like Rita Moreno that we know. I mean, she just looks different. Anyway, she can be seen in The Thing About Harry, as well as the new Hulu original Into the Dark. She was in a series called Rob Riggle's Ski Master Academy, which I think is hilarious. But most people can know her from the TV Netflix series Glow as the daughter of Marc Maron's character. Her name is Britt Baron.
Okay. God, I still need to get around to seeing Glow. There's so many good actresses that I like in it.
Yes, you do.
Okay. Well, my how old did you say Rita was originally?
Rita was 30.
Okay, that's what I have too. My actress is even older. She's 36 now. She's going to be dancing out there with these teenage kids. She was born in New York City, but on the Lower East Side. Sorry, guys. But she was born to parents of Puerto Rican descent. She's in Lords of Dogtown. She's in A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints. She's in Hamlet 2. And she's in the aforementioned Fruitvale Station. Her name is Melanie Diaz. We've got one more, right?
Yeah, bring it home.
Bernardo. Bernardo was played by George Chakiris, who I believe he was Greek in real life. Chelsea, who's going to be in the remake of West Side Story?
His name is David Alvarez, and he doesn't even have a picture on IMDb.
Boo.
Play Bernardo in the remake?
Yep.
Okay. So I want to be jealous of Sean's pick. Who did you pick, Sean, for Bernardo?
George Chakiris is 27. My actor's 28. He's from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Whew. Andrew.
Chelsea.
And Buck.
I guess.
David Alvarez is from Quebec.
Well, thanks for adding that. he was in Shaft. He was in Tut. He was in Now Apocalypse. A lot of people saw him and hated him in Zombieland Double Tap as the dweeby music guy that absconded with the other sister. Evan Yoja.
Oh.
Okay. my actor is 28 now as well, but he grew up in Santa Monica, where his late mother was of Mexican descent. He makes an appearance in a movie that makes fun of Canada called Yoga Hosers. I don't recommend it. He's in Truth or Dare, but most people know him from his leading role on Teen Wolf. It's Tyler Posey.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm going to recommend to myself that I do a little bit more research before I decide not to rewatch a movie.
I don't recommend this movie.
Chelsea?
I do, only because I like the dancing.
Okay. And so I guess that means it's time for our bonus segment, which is going to be a battle royale between the man of the hour, of course, Saul Bass, and we can't forget about Lance Bass or Billy the Big Mouth Bass. You gotta pick one.
Oh, shit.
All three have had a major, major impact on Western art and culture and really our society in general.
Lance Bass.
So this is easy for me because I was a teenage girl in the 90s and I loved NSYNC, and Lance Bass is going to win.
He's going to stab him with those frosted tips.
Oh, fuck yes.
There you go. So you did know.
Choreographed dance moves.
Sean, you did know who Lance Bass was?
Yeah.
Good.
He was the gay one.
No, that's true though. He's very openly gay right now and is married, and they're trying to do like in vitro or something with a woman.
Okay. What the fuck?
Outside of the two of them. I probably didn't read that whole story.
I was also going to say he came off as being the dumb one too, and if they were trying to do in vitro on him,
that
would check out. I'm going to say Saul Bass. I got to say Saul Bass. The guy's a master. He's a fucking
And he is the man of the hour, and you do share an occupational passion with him.
Oh yeah, yeah. He's a ninja when it comes to graphics.
All right, well, I think it's only appropriate then that I vote for Big Mouth Billy Bass, the mounted animatronic singing fish that you can still buy today. I should have looked up how long they've been around, but maybe that's a good job for Dana.
Oh my God.
All right, let's go ahead and wrap it up, guys. This has been fun.
Yep.
Chelsea, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And do you have anything that you want to plug this week?
I do. On Sunday, when this episode drops, it's my son's 9th birthday. So happy birthday, Holden.
Ah, happy birthday to him. And next, I want to thank my co-host and co-producer, the engineer, the brew boss himself. Thank you, sir, for doing what you do. Anything you want to plug?
Sure, I want to plug two things. One, whether it was wise or not, our businesses are gradually reopening here in South Carolina. So Seminar Brewing, that's seminarbrewing.com, is open for outdoor business, soon to be open indoor business at half capacity. So that's happening. But I also want to plug all the mothers out there for Mother's Day. You guys are great. Without you, I wouldn't be here. I came from a mother. Most of you don't know that. But it's true. So yeah. Moms.
Wow. Thanks for reminding me that this is coming out on Mother's Day. I'll have to give mine a call. I love you, Mom. Do you know what next week's episode is, Sean?
This is the Alfred Hitchcock episode.
For our season 6 finale. Seems like it was just season 1. So I do have a question for you. So the reason we're doing it next week is because May 18th marks the 66th anniversary of the premiere screening of Dial M for Murder. So for the finale, we will be discussing the films of Alfred Hitchcock. Question, and there's a little lead up to it. The first film Hitchcock directed for producer David O. Selznick was in 1940. The first film for Selznick, he had done work prior to that, was called Rebecca, and it won Best Picture. The total number of Oscar nominations, including winners, earned by films that he directed is 50. But Alfred Hitchcock himself never won the Academy Award for Best Director. However, while accepting the Irving Thalberg Memorial Award, now I don't know how he accepted a memorial award while he was still alive, but at the 1967 Academy Awards, he delivered the shortest acceptance speech in Academy Award history. What did he say, Chelsea?
Thank you. I don't know.
Thank you. You are correct. That's exactly what he said.
Hooray! I'm the winner.
He was a little bit spiteful that out of his huge and amazing body of work, he never got the Best Director award. He was nominated for it like 4 or 5 times, but never got it. We also want to say thank you to you, the listeners. Please remember to give us a rating or a review or a subscription on whatever podcatcher app it is that you're hearing us on or want to hear us on. Also, you can follow us on Twitter. We're at Cinema Chop Shop. Facebook is Cinema Chop Shop. Our email, cinemachopshop@gmail.com. And then the beers, if Sean reminds me, the beers that we checked in today, I'll check them in on Untapped. That's UNTAPPD. It just doesn't feel the same if I'm not actually getting to taste the beer.
You said
but I did check in the one that you checked in last week. I put that on Untapped.
Good.
All right. And then finally, farewell. Thank you, listeners. Please remember to watch, chop, retrofit.
And tip your animators.